Good evening and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. This evening's program is being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's International Relations Forum and with the Marines Memorial Association. I'm Major General Mike Myatt, President and CEO of the Marines Memorial Association and your chair for this evening's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and the Marines Memorial Association at marineclub.com. It is now my pleasure to introduce this evening's special guest, General Stefan Abrial, NATO Supreme Allied Commander, Transformation. General Stefan Abrial received appointment by the North Atlantic Council as Supreme Allied Commander, Transformation in Norfolk, Virginia, on 29 July 2009. He's the first European to be appointed permanently as head of a NATO Strategic Command. General Abrial graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy in 1974 and completed pilot training at the French Air Force Academy in 1976. He's had extensive experience both as a fighter pilot and an operational commander. He has a wide-ranging background that includes operations in coalition environments at the tactical, operational, and strategic levels. He served in a unit of the German Luftwaffe from 1981 to 1984 and with a unit of the Greek Air Force in 1988. In 1990 and 1991, he took part in the liberation of Kuwait as commander of the French Air Force 5th Fighter Squadron during Operation Desert Storm. From 1996 to 1999, he served at the NATO International Military Staff in Brussels. He's a graduate of the U.S. Air War College in Montgomery, Alabama, and of the French Institute for Advanced Studies in National Defense in Paris. He served as the French Air Force Chief of Staff from 2006 to 2009. He has, among other distinctions, been elevated to the rank of Grand Officer in the French Legion of Honor and was awarded the German Verdienstkreuz der Bundeswehr Silver. Please help me welcome General Stefan Abrial.
Thank you very much, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's always a great pleasure for me to be back in California, and a real honor to speak at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you so much for your invitation. I know that, I think if I look at your website last week, you had a presentation by David McCullough about Americans in Paris. Today, please bear with a Parisian in America. And thank you very much, General Myatt, for your very kind introduction, as well as for your great work at the Marines Memorial Fund, from keeping alive the memory of fallen heroes to preparing the future through your scholarship program. I'm glad we could meet today. 20 years ago, we were together in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, but we were separated by about 30,000 feet altitude. And I'm very grateful that as distinguished a scholar as Dr. Thomas Henriksen will be moderating the question and answer period afterwards. I must also commend you for your choice of dates in planning this event. Today, 230 years ago, General Cornwallis sent out an officer with a white flag to negotiate his surrender to the American and French troops that had trapped him in Yorktown, a surrender that would be signed 2 days later on the 19th of October. It is therefore a perfect day to reflect on the value of alliances and coalitions, and for a French officer, any occasion to recall a victory of the British is a good one, since we haven't always been that successful. As you may have noted, before being appointed Supreme Allied Commander Transformation, I was fortunate to be posted twice in the U.S., as well as in three European countries other than my own. And one thing I felt in all these places is that NATO is often underappreciated. One commentator said recently that NATO was seen as American by the Europeans and as European by Americans, when it is truly our common transatlantic enterprise. This evening, I would like to share with you my conviction that NATO is more than ever the indispensable military alliance, in the same way that Secretary Albright spoke of the U.S. as the indispensable nation. But that, at the same time, It needs to continue to adapt to changing circumstances, as it has for over six decades. As you may know, NATO is preparing to hold its next summit in Chicago next spring, an event which has not happened on U.S. soil in 13 years. You may ask what difference that makes. For us at Allied Command Transformation, it is above all the opportunity to spread the word about NATO to a wider U.S. audience. And our message is simple. NATO matters to the U.S., not just as a sideshow, but as a fundamental two-way security commitment. At the core of the alliance are its values, laid out in the 1949 Washington Treaty: democracy, individual liberty, and the rule of law. Ahead of any security consideration, it is adherence to these values that binds NATO. That is what has inspired it to grow from its 12 original members to 28 nations today. But the reason NATO remains the world's indispensable alliance is only because these values are backed up by unparalleled military capabilities. To slightly paraphrase what my compatriot, philosopher Blaise Pascal, said four centuries ago, strength without values would be tyrannical, but values without strength would be impotent. And clearly, NATO is strong, the strongest alliance in the history of the world. Much is said of the fact that the world's center of gravity is shifting from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and I am sure that here, a few miles from the Golden Gate Bridge, there is sympathy for that view. And there's certainly a case for it in terms of manufacturing and trade. But I wonder if the same can truly be said at this point in the area of military capabilities and the readiness to commit them to defend its values and promote the cause of peace. Look at defense spending. Of every $10 dedicated to defense worldwide, over four are spent by the United States and almost three by other NATO allies, making it a total of $7 out of $10 spent in the world are spent by NATO members. Now, it's my bread and butter as head of transformation to note that input, spending on defense, isn't the same as output, the resulting capabilities. But if we look at the ability to project force outside one's borders, of which strategic airlift capabilities are one component, alongside aircraft carriers or less quantifiable areas such as intelligence or satellite communications, NATO is way over 70% of the world's total. There has, for instance, been a lot of media attention dedicated to China sea-testing its first aircraft carrier this past summer, a refitted ex-Soviet hull with conventional propulsion. This may, retrospectively, turn out to be a historic step, but it should be put in perspective of your own country's 11 aircraft carriers. And while those sea trials were going on, France's nuclear-powered carrier was actively engaged in operations off the coast of Libya. So, to misquote Mark Twain, the reports of the death of NATO's military relevance seem to me quite exaggerated. And I approach this question with a special perspective. As a Frenchman whose country had in 1966 left not the alliance itself, but the NATO military structure, and reintegrated it in 2009. Actually, having a French general be the voice of NATO in front of a mostly American audience such as this one would have sounded like a man-bites-dog story not so many years ago. But my country is now back to full participation because we believe that the alliance is one of the main frameworks within which to tackle today's challenges and those that we see emerging. Surely, NATO today isn't your grandfather's NATO. General Lord Ismay, the alliance's first Secretary General, famously said in the 1950s that NATO's purpose at the time was to keep Russia out, Germany down, and America in. Well, that's clearly no longer the case. To make but one point, Ismay's view was clearly Eurocentric. When he said Russia out, he meant out of Europe. But the alliance isn't just about protecting Europe. Take the alliance's mutual defense clause, the cornerstone of the alliance, which unambiguously states that an attack against one member, is considered an attack against all. You will know that this clause was invoked for the first and only time on September 12, 2001, after an attack on American soil. Within days, NATO AWACS, Boeing 707s with airborne radars, were patrolling the U.S. airspace. Admittedly, the alliance was designed in a specific Cold War context, with the territorial defense of Western Europe as its main concern. If Sun Tzu was right in observing that the best victory is winning without battle, NATO has been very successful indeed on this count. But in their wisdom, the drafters of the Washington Treaty created the flexibility the alliance would require to adapt to the very different circumstances of today. Which brings me to present circumstances, and the core of my intervention, what is currently on my mind as the custodian of NATO's military future. What are the top challenges the alliance is facing? There are, of course, many. Though it might look more scholarly if I classified them under multiple headings, I'll go for only two, globalization and budgets. And don't be surprised if they intersect. First, globalization has changed and will continue to change NATO. If you think of NATO up to the 70s, you'll probably picture tanks patrolling the Iron Curtain or submarines playing cat and mouse off the coast of Norway. If you think of NATO in the 80s, the deployment of Pershing II intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Germany may come to mind. In the 90s, you may think of the alliance's peace-enforcing operations in the Balkans. In all those years, NATO's focus evolved, but its actions remained centered on the European soil. Think now of NATO in the past decade, from 2001 to today. What may most stand out is our engagement in Afghanistan. 10 years ago, this was seen as a considerable shift. We spoke then of an out-of-area operation, as if it were somewhat unnatural, something of an anomaly. But today, it's the expression out-of-area itself that seems quaint to NATO ears. What happened 10 years ago, of course, was 9/11. As those attacks had been planned and conducted from Central Asia, it was clear that we couldn't go on acting as if only the North Atlantic's immediate surroundings impacted upon our collective security. This realization reflected a growing globalization of threats and challenges. Now, globalization is in many ways a wonderful thing. One can only take heart at the growth rates in so many parts of the world during this past decade. In Asia, in South America, and perhaps most encouragingly of all, in Africa. One key aspect of this phenomenon has been the spread of technology. And again, this has often been very positive. The UN just published a report noting that in the last 20 years, child mortality has been more than halved in many regions of the world, from North Africa to Latin America and most of Asia. But of course, there's a growing trend of high-end technology being used to disruptive ends, by state as well as non-state actors. High on the list is the development of ballistic missiles by a growing number of countries and their ability to arm such missiles with a mass destruction capability. In response, one of the decisions taken at the last summit of NATO heads of state and government a year ago in Lisbon, Portugal, was to establish a NATO-wide anti-ballistic missile capability to protect our populations. This was a momentous step, but a logical one. It is really just another instance of NATO continuing its mission of collective defense while adapting it to changing circumstances. The first example of a globalization of challenges I gave a few minutes ago was that of Afghanistan. And I noted that it has been a dominant issue for the alliance this past decade, and still is. Actually, much of our work at Allied Command Transformation is conducted in support of this operation. From training of deployed staff to, for example, establishing a comprehensive plan to fight roadside bombs. We also call them improvised explosive devices, which cause more than half our combat deaths and inflict untold harm upon the Afghan civilian population as well. But when we think of emerging challenges, we need to consider them even more broadly. One of the main features of globalization is that it has led to a greater interdependence of nations and regions, as international trade accounts for an ever larger proportion of economic activity. This interdependence creates vulnerabilities. The U.S. car market is still impacted by the supply chain disturbances caused by the Japanese earthquake of last March, and the volcano eruption last year brought European air traffic to a standstill for several days. And these examples are just natural phenomena. But the vulnerability they reveal can be seen as an opportunity by potential foes. Moreover, flows of goods, people, and information upon which we depend transit through what are now often called the global commons, that is, international waters and international airspace, outer space, and the most recent addition, cyberspace. These environments are not comparable in every aspect, but they do share the common trait of not falling under any one nation's jurisdiction. Responding to challenges in these domains therefore presents difficulties that range from the operational to the legal. One example of disruption is piracy off the coast of Somalia. You've certainly heard of this issue, but I believe it actually underreported given its true scale. Did you know that almost 1,200 people were taken hostage in that area just in 2010? And the economic cost is in the billions of dollars a year. NATO is active in dealing with this challenge through its Operation Ocean Shield, and so are the European Union and the US. But the area over which pirates are operating is the size of Western Europe. There is simply no easy answer. This is just one of the types of missions we must now keep in mind in designing new capabilities. And as I mentioned new capabilities, I'll transition to what is really the second great part of the equation, the budget issue. You may have noticed that Western economies have been going through some turbulence these past years. Hopefully, growth, earnings, and job numbers will recover or continue to recover within months or years. But the concerns raised by our public debts and consequently our public expenditure will continue well into a recovery. As far as defense expenditure goes, European nations in particular are bracing for a long budgetary winter. Since 2008, the European members of NATO have already gone through defense spending cuts that cumulatively add up to the total defense budget of Germany. The problem is that these cuts are driven by budgetary considerations more than by an assessment of a strategic context. As I said, it is not my analysis that the need for military capabilities is decreasing in a globalized world. Happily, the number of open conflicts is on a long-term downward trend, but not the potential for very grave disturbance. Another problem is that many nations weren't at a very high level from the beginning, which worsens the impact of any further drop. This is the case in absolute terms, in its consequences for capabilities. And it may be the case in relative terms, as any alliance requires a sense that the burden is being shared. Contrary, perhaps, to some perceptions, burden sharing is a reality in operations. All 28 allied nations have been part of our operations in Afghanistan, for example, and many European nations have experienced the highest numbers of military losses since World War II. However, as far as budgets go, even before our current crisis, few NATO members managed to honor the common objective of dedicating 2% of a GDP to defense. Today, there are less than a handful that reach that level, and I understand the concerns often expressed on this side of the Atlantic. But the U.S. itself is not immune from this growing pressure on its own budget. As you well know, the debt ceiling agreement reached in August may trigger up to an $850 billion reduction over 10 years, which would be more than the total predicted defense spending of any other NATO member, including France, including Great Britain, over the same period of time. So the main question for me is, how can NATO respond to this context? In the words of NATO Secretary General, former Danish Prime Minister Anders Fogh Rasmussen, our nations shouldn't spend less. They cannot spend more. So in the face of increasing requirements, they must spend better. We simply need to have more defense for every dollar, euro, or pound which we spend, and that is where NATO should help. As a way to demonstrate that the alliance is part of a solution, not part of a problem, our military structure itself is downsizing by a third, from 13,000 to below 9,000 people. And this comes after a previous downsizing by a half in the late 90s. We're doing this without significant loss of capability, by hunting down duplication within our structure and with national entities. Future alliance operations will probably rely more on national headquarters that will have been certified to common NATO standards. But the bulk of NATO's response is what we call the Smart Defense Initiative. This is an effort to increase cost effectiveness in defense spending across the board in a series of directions. First, prioritization. Is our spending really aligned with our actual current and predicted needs? We all know that other considerations sometimes interfere with such an alignment, most commonly inertia. Another direction is better working with the European Union, which these past years has acquired a new role in security and defense matters. Our memberships intersect quite extensively. 21 nations are members of both organizations. So working to avoid unwanted duplication and to deconflict our initiatives clearly makes sense. The third direction is towards wider-ranging multinational capability solutions. After 62 years together, NATO nations are united by common doctrines, shared standards, and the experience that if we are to engage in major operations, chances are that it will be jointly. If there is a perfect forum to realize economies of scale by developing capabilities that can be shared by several countries, we are it. For smaller-sized countries, this may allow a degree of specialization. Concentrating their efforts on areas of excellence in which they can reach a critical mass while relying on allies for other capabilities. Of course, multinational initiatives already exist. Several European air forces have, for example, joined over 30 years ago to cooperate in acquiring and supporting F-16 fighter jets. And multinational procurement is now routine, from the C-17 and Airbus A400 Mike airlift capabilities to helicopters such as the Tiger. What we are working on at this time is identifying possible new areas for multinational cooperation and to make it the new standard for how NATO does business. And it's not only about procurement. For example, my headquarters is in charge of accrediting centers of excellence in NATO. These are institutions dedicated to a specific area of expertise, such as medical support in operations or cyber defense, that one nation hosts, others co-sponsor, but all NATO members can use. Working this way is simply smarter defense. Like any of the speakers you invite here to talk of their area of expertise, I could go on, but I hope that these words will have given you a sense of my concerns and vision as NATO's commander in charge of looking ahead to our future security, which will certainly include strategic surprises. Let me finish, however, with the observation that it is not self-sufficient. Cooperation, not only within the alliance but well beyond, is now more than ever an essential component of its success. Both globalization and the quest for greater cost effectiveness make engaging with other nations and international organizations all the more necessary. For example, Russia is now a valued partner. The old saw about keeping Russia out could now be reversed. We truly want them in. NATO is keen to develop its ballistic missile defense system in cooperation and coordination with theirs. Other partnerships are underway with countries south of the Mediterranean and in the Persian Gulf region. And significantly, nations from both areas took part in Operation Unified Protector in Libya, which sent a powerful message of inclusiveness. And we have extensive bilateral relationships with other nations, for example, in the Pacific Basin, Japan, and Australia. A more engaged NATO also means one that collaborates better with other international organizations that have an important role in security issues, such as the United Nations, European Union again, and many others. And finally, we are building an alliance that is more engaged with a wide array of actors whose synergy is essential to implementing the comprehensive whole-of-government and often whole-of-society approaches, which alone can enable us to face modern crises. We, therefore, need to engage more and with other players, from government agencies to NGOs or private firms. In closing, I would like to come back to what will be a fundamental date in NATO's calendar, the Chicago Summit next May. The four central topics that it will tackle relate very much to points that I mentioned this evening: the future of Afghanistan, missile defense, smart defense, and partnerships. I expect this occasion to be an opportunity for a great public debate around these topics, and hopefully I will have helped kickstart such a discussion by sharing my thoughts with you this evening. Thank you very much for your attention, and I will be delighted to answer your questions.
Thank you very much, General Stéphane Aubryal, NATO Supreme Command, Allied Commander Transformation. My name is Thomas Hendrickson. I'm a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and your moderator for this evening. We have a lot of questions, so let me begin. You mentioned a lot about some of the problems NATO has faced, particularly in times of budget austerity. And we know that both Robert Gates, the former Secretary of Defense of the United States, and Leon Panetta, the current Secretary of Defense of the United States, were both very concerned, and you mentioned it yourself, about the crisis within NATO nations not spending the required 2% of GDP for military forces. So my question is to you, what kind of crisis do you envision will motivate your European colleagues to increase their defense budgets? Will it take a reemergence Russia under Putin, who Russia has already, as you know, attacked Georgia? It has Putin likes to refer to himself as Brezhnev, who was the author of the Brezhnev Doctrine, but meant that no territory would ever escape Soviet control. He was the invader of Czechoslovakia and then of Afghanistan. So would it be that kind of crisis that would motivate your partners to come up with the money that is needed to really foster a really good defense?
It's difficult to envisage what will be the next crisis and how things are going to evolve. We try to look into the future and to envisage all possible developments. What I can say, the assessment is very clear. There is no strong requirement, there is no rule, but a common agreed yardstick of 2% of GDP as the right amount to spend on defense. As I mentioned, only a handful of nations do reach this level of defense spendings. And the trend is downwards due to the economic crisis. But this is only true in Europe, probably also on this side of the Atlantic, but it's not true in the rest of the world. If you look any other place, defense spendings are increasing, and sometimes in two-digit numbers. So obviously we do have a problem. How can we face it? Well, we do identify what are the essential requirements we are facing. What do we need to develop, which kinds of capability, and, of course, how much it would cost. This is part of our job, specifically in Allied Command Transformation. A crisis is never welcome, but it's always helpful to test the validity of our initial assessments and to see whether the requirements we have identified are the right ones. And I can tell you that the most recent one, the crisis in Libya, has confirmed our initial assessments. And Libya has also shown a new model of the way of doing operations for NATO. NATO back in 1949 had been created in order to make sure that totally destroyed and ruined Europe could still be defended, linking the two sides of the Atlantic for a long duration of time. In those times, we were facing a very strong threat, which we all knew. It was never envisaged that NATO would act outside Europe, and it was intended in the treaty itself, behind the words, you can see that there was a will to make sure that the U.S. would be engaged and would be leading. Well, the first time NATO has evoked Article 5, I mentioned it, was for the defense of this country, America, not Europe. And now in Libya, we saw a new model of operation where the U.S. is contributing heavily, but is willing not to lead. And the leadership of the operation was performed by Canada and European allies. So we have a new way of considering operations. And this is also a lesson which we have to learn. If this happens again in the future, are those European allies who contribute most, do they have in their inventory all the capabilities needed to conduct another crisis of that type? I wouldn't say similar crisis because no two crises are similar. But do we have the capabilities required to do it again in another format, but with the same kind of arrangements? This is a good wake-up call, I would say. The other answer which NATO is giving now is this initiative I tried to describe, which we call smart defense. Since we all know that the budget difficulties we face are here to stay, we need to spend better. And the best way to spend better is to put our thinking and our resources together and to cooperate in the development of new capabilities, making sure that, for example, small groupings of nations, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 nations, address this or that capability, develop it together, which will mean a reduced cost for each of them, which will mean that for the same amount of money, we will be able to have the right capabilities, the capabilities which we need in the future to collectively, as an alliance, be up to the level of ambition which has been decided by our heads of state and government.
Thank you. Moving on to other questions that have been asked by the audience, and I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is General Stefan Abril, NATO Supreme Allied Commander Transformation, who is discussing international security in the age of austerity. General, you mentioned this smarter spending. The idea, I think, is more compartmentalization, less compartmentalization, and having certain countries do certain things very well. You could take any one country and it might be a specialist in this, and another country be a specialist in that. Well, one of the challenges with that, and it makes a lot of good theoretical sense, one of the challenges is what happens when they don't participate. As Germany did not participate in the Libya campaign, then you're missing that capability.
The first thing on which I was maybe not clear enough, the Smart Defense Initiative is not only specialization. It's three pillars. It's cooperation, doing things together. It's prioritization, looking what we have to do first and how to set our priorities, and specialization. All three contribute to this smart defense vision, which was expressed by the Secretary General of NATO. Now, whatever pillar you consider, prioritization, cooperation, specialization, you always have to make sure that you address the issue of the right balance between sovereignty and solidarity. sovereignty because NATO is an alliance of sovereign nations, and each nation is totally free to decide whatever she will contribute to any operation. Coming back to the example you have given, I want to emphasize the fact that all 28 nations of NATO agreed on the intervention in Libya. All 28 supported the intervention. But then it comes to contribution. Who does contribute, and among those who contribute, who does what? And this is the right sovereign, independent choice of every single nation. And therefore, this notion of the balance between solidarity and sovereignty, which I tried to explain. We are bound by solidarity in the alliance, and each nation is entitled to decide what she wants, because she is sovereign. So when we do things together, there is a double obligation to address the issue of the availability of the capability we develop, both for the alliance as a whole, whatever the individual contribution of any nation will be, and two, the guaranteed access to this capability by any one of these nations who did contribute to it, even if it's for only national purposes. So we have to strike this right balance. But the, seen from an alliance point of view, the question of the assured availability of a capability once needed is important, and it has to be dealt with upfront.
Thank you very much. Another question. This concerns about the future of NATO, because as we know, the United States is looking for ways to save money, and there's more and more talk of withdrawing forces from NATO countries. And as you indicated, NATO is our United States' best alliance. It's a very important alliance and probably the greatest alliance ever. But what role do you envision then as the United States perhaps pulls back more for France and Germany, which have really been the leaders of NATO in many respects, along with the British? And so do you see a different kind of relationship emerging as the United States may withdraw more forces and lead from behind, as the current phrase is?
Well, again, coming back to the sovereignty issue, it's up to each nation to decide how she wants to contribute. And the U.S. example in the Libya crisis is a typical one. The importance of having U.S. troops in Europe is still as vivid as in the past. It will be up to the U.S. to decide how many. But the relationship, the solidarity which it shows, is essential to the alliance. If you look at symbols, if you wish, look at the two strategic commands in NATO. Having one European guy being a strategic commander on U.S. soil on the one side of the Atlantic, and an American guy, my good friend Admiral Stavridis, being a European strategic commander, an American strategic commander in Europe on the other side of the Atlantic, is an extremely powerful symbol of the transatlantic link and a good demonstration of solidarity in the alliance. Well, I think this has been to be demonstrated also through troop deployments and through contributions. So, again, it's up to each nation to decide, but I don't think that the way the Libya crisis has been managed is a good reason to advocate for more drawdown.
Okay. Let me play a little devil's advocate here. Last week, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, made a very important statement. She wrote in one of the foreign policy magazines that America now faces a pivot point in its history, and the United States should pivot toward Asia, should pivot more and more, because that's where America's future, economic future, and also we face real challenges in Asia, which we don't face in Europe at the present time. So I'd like your reaction to Hillary Clinton's prescription for American foreign policy.
Well, I don't think it's in my capacity to make any judgment on the political posture of any nation. But it's true. Everybody knows that the center of gravity of the world has been moving towards Asia. Does it mean that there should be a weakening of a link between Europe and America, with Europe and the U.S., I would say no. I would argue no. Look back at the treaty. We are sharing the same values. We are ready to defend these values, and the well-known Article 5 of the Washington Treaty states very clearly that we all stand together to defend any one of us who would be attacked. This is something unique in the world. This is something which creates bounds, and this is something also which has been exercised through the 60 years of history of NATO, the most successful alliance in history. I don't say it, some scholars have written it already. And if you look at all the crises in the world, the way nations engage, be it in a coalition led by NATO or individual nations, the fact that we have been working together during these 60 years, creating the habit of working together, of operating together, of understanding each other's culture, is something so important that I think we should never give it up. Never. And personally, maybe because I'm a Frenchman, I think that the links between my continent and this continent are so strong that they will never disappear.
Thank you. No, I share your views on the common values, but I wonder if you could speak to a little bit different subject. NATO, you've talked a lot about NATO as a military alliance, and it's all very important, interventions in places like Libya, about how it's common defense of all for one and one for all. But can you tell us a little bit more about many new countries came in NATO after the fall of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, and it was very important for those countries to join NATO and very important that they were included in NATO because of the values that Western NATO, the old NATO, so it might be, it's for the new NATO. Can you speak to that a little bit about how these values of democracy and free trade and human rights were embodied in NATO and also I think we're spread and entrenched in those new countries.
I think that it's absolutely remarkable to look at the history of NATO. NATO started with 12 countries back in 1949, enlarged slowly to 16 by the time the Berlin Wall fell. And after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the end of the Cold War, we jumped from 16 to 28 today, which proves that NATO attracts nations. And as you rightly mentioned, many nations who were behind the Iron Curtain are now members of NATO, and they are solid and very strong contributors. Every nation brings with itself a part of his history, of her history, of course. These new membership in NATO have reminded us that we need to concentrate, as written in the Washington Treaty, on collective defense. If you read articles or statements about NATO somewhere between 1990 and 2005, we emphasize very much and more this out-of-area, this expeditionary attitude and capability. And maybe we didn't talk enough about collective defense. Maybe we didn't demonstrate it enough. And you're right. Those who had suffered a lot in the recent past, wanted to make sure that within NATO they would get the security which they were looking for and they had been missing in the past. So the result of this can be read very easily in the strategic concept, which has been agreed by the NATO heads of state and government in Lisbon last year. You can see the right balance between the collective defense mission and the ability to deploy and be a player in crisis management. This is probably the most visible aspect of this evolution in the past 20 years.
Okay, thank you. Another good question is the concerns, what are called rules of engagement. Rules of engagement, I know, are operable for soldiers when they can fire the weapon. What sort of rules? Do they fire at anything they see, or do they have to wait to be fired upon, or what are the circumstances? And can you tell us a little bit about NATO's rules of engagements, how they were formed in Afghanistan, by individual countries, how they got together, how they established those, or is there kind of, do you feel that there should be a more NATO policy toward that? Because countries have differed on that, as you know, in Afghanistan.
The rules of engagement are something extremely important because they are the translation of the political will into the military institution. We have rules of engagement which are decided in NATO at 28. And as every other decision in NATO, it's a consensus rule, which means all 28 nations have to agree on them. But then, on top of this, you have the I would say, supplementary conditions which the contributing nations put on their own forces. They may or may not be deployed in this or that area. They may or may not be used for this or that mission. For military commanders, it's always a difficulty. I think, General, you may have been living through these difficulties in the past also. But it is a condition for nation A or B to contribute to the operation. And in the end stage, what is more important? To have fewer troops which are allowed to do whatever the commander wants, or to have more nations, more flags contributing to the operation. The power of a large coalition is very, very important. It is our effort, when I say we, our effort, we military, we always try to reduce the number of what we call the caveats, the national conditions, limitations put on the way we can use the troops. But they are a fact. Again, they are a political decision, and it's up to us to make the best out of what the nations are ready to see the troops doing. And with this in mind, look at Afghanistan today. We have 49 nations, soon to be 50, contributing to the operations. If we would not agree with the notion of caveats, I would argue that the number would be much smaller. So it's a typical example, I think, of the importance, the political weight of a coalition which can grow that large, provided it doesn't stop the commander from doing his business, of course. So commanders do have difficulties, but they still can fight. And that's the most important aspect.
Oh, thank you. Well, a personal question. In your various assignments within NATO, what has been your most challenging personal problem, your problem you've had so far to deal with in your NATO assignments?
Language? No, no problem with language. As you know, NATO has two official languages, English and French. So, no problem. I would think, probably like in other non-military fora, making sure that we understand each other's culture, where we come from, the weight of history, why does a citizen or a soldier or an officer from this or that country not react the same way as his neighbor from the neighboring country? Why, how are they educated? How are they trained? How do we best make sure that when we say something, we mean the same thing, we understand the same thing? How do we best make sure that when we engage, we will understand each other? And this applies, of course, to all kinds of equipment, encrypted radios must be able to talk to each other, but people must also be able to talk to each other, to understand each other. And it's true in training, and we do a lot of training to make sure that this level of interoperability is continuously maintained, nurtured, and increased. But it's even more true in combat, because when you are under stress, you really need to make sure that you know what your comrades right and left are doing, and why and how. So I guess that I wouldn't say it's a challenge, but it's probably the most interesting part of being in NATO, is this mixture of cultures and this mutual knowledge.
Are you very concerned with ethnic tensions that are resurfacing in Kosovo? Because, you know, that was a NATO mission, and it seemed to have quieted things down in 1999, but now we have this reemergence, and it looks more dangerous again.
Well, it is still a NATO mission. We still have the KFOR, Kosovo force, operating there under the NATO banner. Yes, of course, the reemergence of violence is a concern. We were going on a very constant slope towards the end of the mission, going through, technically, through gates, which have to be approved at political level. But the reduction of troops, the reduction of the NATO mission in Kosovo can only happen if the situation on the ground is stabilized. So any peak of violence is a concern. Now, the fact that there are some local and short-term increases in this violence can happen. It happens everywhere. No curve is totally steady and linear. The concern is, will it last long or not? Will it degenerate or not? So far, the impression is no. The impression is that we may have been obliged to delay a little bit the next step, but we are still on the right track, and Kosovo is doing well for the future.
Thank you. Another question is very interesting now that the Arctic seems to be experiencing melting of its waters. And as we know, beneath those waters, seem to be a great wealth, mineral wealth, and also the very passageway through the Arctic leads to ship commerce, or could lead within the next decade or two, ships moving through there. Do you see that as an important role for NATO? Because some of the NATO members are, in fact, involved in the Arctic region, Canada, the United States, mm-hmm. Denmark, and so on.
Some NATO members and some non-NATO members, yes. Too. Yeah. The climate change and the consequences in the Arctic are an important topic. You mentioned the resources which might become available there, the fact that new sea lanes are opening. This is, by the way, something which we have addressed in a study we have made on the global commons, on the maritime aspect. These new possibilities in the maritime domain have to be considered. Should it become a NATO concern or a NATO topic? Well, it's up to the 28 nations in NATO to decide. The fact that is for sure is that we must be helpful in making sure that this new trend will be managed in cooperation. There will be competition, of course, because the resources are there, but we would favor cooperation and not confrontation. Will this become one day a NATO mission? Again, it's up to the 28 nations to decide.
Okay. That leads us to, since we're talking about globalization, you mentioned at the beginning of your talk, and you again alluded to this possible new mission in the Arctic. Do you think that NATO should have some sort of relationship with China?
I think that NATO must be ready for partnership with all parts of the world. We have been working already very much with many partner nations in various fora and framework. We have what we call the Partnership for Peace. We have a Mediterranean Dialogue. We have the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative. We have individual partnerships also. The notion of partnership should not be strictly limited to geography. And therefore, the fact that you mentioned China, but there are other major powers which are not close to NATO borders. The relationship between NATO and these nations must be developed. To what level? What do we want to do together? Well, let's look with time what can occur and what we can achieve together. But the more we engage other nations, including China, Brazil, India, and others, the better. We need to talk, we need to exchange views, and hopefully develop a very positive relationship.
Good. Thank you. The same sort of question pertains, and you've already talked to about missile defense. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Defense is, of course, commonly seen as right now against possible nuclear arms or even conventional missiles from Iran. So that leads me and leads a questioner in this case to ask about NATO's role in the Middle East, particularly vis-a-vis Iran and perhaps even towards Syria, which is, for all intents and purposes, a satellite of Iran.
Well, NATO is not deciding on its own to operate anywhere. NATO is always operating under a legitimate United Nations mandate. This is the reason why we have been engaging in the operation over Libya, because of the UN Security Council Resolution 1973, with the task of setting a no-fly zone, an embargo, and protection of the population, which we did. Mission is not over yet, but I would argue that this was it has proven already to be very successful. Now, should NATO engage anywhere else? Again, depends on the community of nations. Will the UN ask for something, ask for an intervention? And if yes, will the 28 nations of NATO decide to take this mandate and to do it? Sovereign choice.
If someone to ask you what NATO should look like in 10 years, both politically and military, what kind of organization do you envision, or would you like to envision? You can answer in both ways.
In 10 years?
10 years.
Probably a slightly increased membership. Forces which are more deployable and more sustainable. Why that? We mentioned before the collective defense aspect and the out-of-area missions. Well, for both, you need the same kind of capabilities. The Cold War times where forces were massed at the border and ready to defend is over. If there's a crisis erupting somewhere, which could be under Article 5, collective defense, in one part of the alliance, if you look at the map, coming from another country, deploying forces from another country to help this nation, will need deployability. And of course, if you want to be effective, you need to be able to stay long until the crisis is resolved. So it's an aspect in which we are working very much today in our work on capabilities. We need the forces in the NATO nations to be more deployable and to be more sustainable. And I'm very confident that in 10 years we will be much better in both aspects.
How about in political terms, do you think? Do you see it in another vision rather than just deployable forces? In a more political sense, do you see it NATO evolving in any sense?
Through an increase of partnerships, yes. If I come back to the numbers, when NATO enlarged from 16 to 19 nations, many people say at 19 you will never make a decision anymore. It will be impossible. Well, today we are 28. And if you look at history, this time it took 6 days, 6 days only, at 28 nations to come to a consensus and make the right decision to engage in Libya. If you compare this to the months or more which were needed only 20 years ago in Bosnia, 10 years ago in Kosovo, there's huge progress and the proof that the numbers don't hamper decision-making. So I don't think that there's a need to change the rule. It's very important that every single nation is represented in NATO, and it's very important that the consensus rule stays, because as hard as it is to come to a consensus in some issues, when it's there, it carries so much weight, politically speaking. And also, it's so important for our troops, because they know that all nations are behind them when they are deployed somewhere. So I would not change the way politically the alliance is working.
There has been times in the past where the United States has worried about tension between NATO and the European Union. political tension, and the fact that one might siphon off troops, the European Union would siphon off troops and military forces for on its own, and that NATO would be somehow weakened by this because it would no longer be, American would no longer be a direct partnership as it is in NATO today, that Europe might be more tend to go its own way. Can you speak to that? Do you see that as any longer a realistic concern in Washington?
I would think that you asked me the question because I'm French. I think that the tensions between NATO and EU are something of the past. And the fact that my own nation has reintegrated the NATO military structure back in 2009 is a good example that the two institutions can work in a complementary way and do not have to be competitors. To the contrary, if progress is made in one of the institutions, it helps the other, and vice versa. Look at the memberships. 21 nations are members of both. So when France or the UK or Italy or Germany is doing something on the EU side and developing forces, developing capabilities, those are capabilities which will be available also for NATO when Germany operates in the NATO framework. If you look in details into the strategic concept, you will see that the NATO-EU relationship is considered as a strategic partnership, a very important one, and we have to nurture it. Of course, at the highest level, there are difficulties between the two institutions, and we cannot do everything we want. There is a political framework which guides exactly what we can do and not do. But in day-to-day, staff-to-staff work, we do a lot. And in the Smart Defense Initiative, which I have talked about, and the part with my command, Allied Command Transformation, has been doing in the past 6 months, we have been working very closely with the EU, staff to staff, and we have been able to deconflict, to avoid duplication, and to make sure that the results are complementary. So, no, I don't think that there is that many tensions. There are difficulties, which we know, but there are no tensions, and there is a real will on both sides to work as much as we can together.
Okay. We're nearing the end of our allotted time, so this will probably have to be the last question, but it's also a little loaded question. what would you like, at your capacity at NATO, for the United States to do more of or less of? What do you expect from us? What would you like from the United States dealing with NATO in your position and from NATO generally?
Well, I would think the same as from any member. Contribute to NATO reform, to NATO transformation. Contribute to consensus building on all issues. Contribute to global stability and security, which is at the heart of what we do in NATO. I think that the United States is the major contributor as far as capabilities are concerned. And all of the NATO nations are really grateful for that. I'm sure that this will not change in the near future, despite whatever budget cuts you might have here. I tried to explain in my remarks that European nations are also going through very important cuts. So I would expect, again, contributions to stay shared in a sustainable way, an acceptable way by all nations.
Okay, thank you. Our special thanks then to General Stéphane Abriel, the NATO Supreme Allied Commander Transformation. I want to also thank the audience here and our radio and television and internet. Today's program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's International Relations Forum and with the Marines Memorial Association. I'm Tom Hendrickson from the Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you. Sorry for the questions.